Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 34th in a series of discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. Turbulent times, I mean, just the past 36 hours, turbulent seems like an understatement. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today, we're going to be talking about the Middle East. We have with us some newcomers, Michael Kaler, John Robertson, and the old standby substitute, Magic Mike, is back at the third mic. So we appreciate your all being here. And with a topic as difficult as the Middle East, we're going to have to do things a little bit different. And this is mainly for the listening audience because there's a lot of things that may have occurred that we need reminding of because they occurred so long ago. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to preface the questions with little historical narratives. I'm trying to be as concise as I can. And my apologies for if you have to listen to me talk a little bit more than the guests, but we need that. There are a number of major historical events that have led to the present situation of what we now call the Middle East. The years that these events occurred are important for the record, and I'm going to list them. I'm going to let you guys tell me if you know what happened those particular years, but if you don't, we won't let too much dead space go by. So in 632, something significant happened. Anybody know what happened in 632?
Of course, the Big M.
Okay, the Big M bit the dust. Yeah, the Prophet Muhammad died, and subsequent to that, his father-in-law, Bakr, took care of the Sunnis. And his son-in-law, Ali, developed what was the Shiites, okay? Then we move on to 1453. That's a significant date. What happened in 1453? Anybody can jump in.
It'd be the fall of Constantinople.
Right, which would had the Ottoman Empire be established and the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire. That was the end, 1453. Okay, how about 1798? There's something that happened in 1798, which I believe is significant, and I'll explain why, after you guys tell me what happened to
Well, I'll go out on a limb here. I'll say that's the French invasion of Egypt.
Napoleon conquers Egypt, and what happens with that conquering Egypt at that time was the colonialization of the Middle East, basically by the European powers, the French, the British primarily.
And don't forget the Rosetta Stone.
And he recovered the Rosetta Stone, and I forget where it went to, but they seem to be making a lot of money off the software at any rate. Okay, in 1922, that isn't really a date set in stone because it's like right around a lot of things that happened. In 1918, World War I, the Great War, ended, but it took them about 4 years or so to get to the point where the European powers decided that they were going to, the victors, I should say, of World War I, decided they were going to draw the Middle East to their own specifications. That would have been the French, the British. I don't think the U.S. had much to do with that, but they were involved in that.
So that would be the signing of the Sykes-Picot Treaty?
That could be. I defer to your expertise on that one. But they basically withdrew the map of the Middle East and named countries this and that and the other thing. 1948, very significant date.
1948. The British Mandate of Palestine changes names and changes the large portion of its population.
Okay, I call it the birth of Israel. That's what happened in 48. How about
And of course, the Palestinians will refer to it as al-Nakba, which means the disaster.
Okay, well, that's, yeah, from that perspective, certainly. 1967, something happened that year that was Go ahead, John, looks like you got our mic.
There was a little bit of a conflict.
We call it the Six-Day War, where Israel gained a lot of territory. They were attacked, but they ended up gaining a lot of land in that war. 1979. what happened in 1979.
It's the Iran hostage. Yes. Well, it's the fall of the Shah and mm-hmm. the beginning of the Iran hostage crisis.
Yeah, beginning of the Iran hostage crisis. 2001 happened in September.
September 2001.
Significant part of the American history, for sure.
9/11.
And in 2016, Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. Okay. Let's start with Israel, which was born into a war with its Arab neighbors and immediately proved that militarily, the brand new Jewish state was not to be taken lightly. They kicked butt even from the get-go in 1948 with small arms fire. Israel's right to exist and the security measures it employs to protect that right to exist has resulted in an area populated by Palestinians who endure economic hardships and political instability. The question is there a better balance that can be imposed by Israel on the Palestinians, which could ensure both security and a decent living situation for the residents of that place? If so, what changes would you recommend in order to make life better for the Palestinians that would protect Israel's security?
I would submit that that's probably a twofold answer, one from each side of that discussion point. One would be the Israelis. There are things that they do, like the assigning home sites inside some of these
settlements. Settlements.
Right. Yeah. Some of the people call them settlements, and they're assigning those spaces. And there is another part where there are some of the Palestinians who have applied for and received citizenship and are
Citizenship to Israel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then there are others who refuse to even apply or attempt to do that because of their political beliefs
and what they still believe is a disaster. Are they dual citizenships of both Palestine and Israel? You don't know. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
It's interesting. I think from a Palestinian perspective, one would say, well, it's interesting the way they frame the question, in what way can Israel, because you use the verb impose. And
they do have the power to impose, though, at this point.
Yes. I'll grant that. But, you know, there's a difference between power and moral authority, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an interesting I've been thinking about this for, you know, decades, like a lot of people. And the way that I see it is that it's really a true dilemma from which there seems to be no actual I don't see a way out of it. On the one hand, you have 2,000 years of Jewish history where they have been driven out or, you know, murdered wherever they go.
Mm-hmm.
So the Zionist project of there being a Jewish state with Jewish self-determination certainly seems to be a laudable goal, and one can hardly blame anybody for being a Zionist. On the other hand, the land that is comprised by the Jewish state of Israel currently was taken by people who were living there mm-hmm. and who were blameless with respect to the Holocaust and
all the suffering
and all the suffering
years.
Of the Jews. So basically the Arabs who lived in that area, the Palestinians, they are being asked to bear the burden and bear the cost for a historic balancing for which they're not responsible. Right? They're not responsible for the Holocaust. They really weren't responsible for anti-Semitism in Europe for over a thousand years.
The situation perfectly, but
Then the question is, well, what can you do now?
Is there anything we may leave it a little bit better? I mean, I think 40 more people were wounded here today.
So for years, right, the United States supported the so-called two-state solution, right, which is that there'll be a Palestinian state and an Israeli state, and there'll be separate states. And the Palestinians will get a sovereign state on land which they retained. And the Israelis will have a state in an area that they acquired mostly after 1948 and up until 67.
67 right? is when they made the big land grab war.
Yes. They were attacked,
but they acquired
considerable territory.
Yes.
In fact, for years we called what's now – some people would call the you know, the area that's administered by the Palestinian Authority. We used to call those the occupied territories, right? Mm-hmm. Occupied by Israel in the 67 war. Right. Now, here's the thing is that how do you solve this dilemma? Because the Jews certainly are entitled to a place in which they feel safe, in which mm-hmm. they are safe, in which they have mm-hmm. self-determination. On the other hand, to take the land from people who were blameless, and that seems to be itself a kind of a crime. And what's the U.S.? What's our involvement in this? You know, we've supported Israel for, you know, several decades now, but we've tried to also, up till fairly recently, be a fair broker to the Palestinians to a limited point. And frankly, what I think we're seeing now in Israel, with the rise of the Likud party being stronger and stronger and stronger.
They keep winning elections.
The Israelis are moving towards a position of having a Jewish state that is not just a homeland for the Jews, but unlike Israel was previously, where you had Arab citizens with civil rights, they're now, Likud is basically pushing this idea that you're going to have a two-tiered citizenship in Israel, and it's going to be formalized in the law. And this is kind of a tricky position, with especially since Likud takes the view that the so-called occupied territories should just simply be part of a greater Israel and be, have one nation in that area, which is a Jewish state, really along what Likud's ultimate vision, and just you can just see what their politicians say. Ultimately, their vision is something kind of along the lines of what South Africa once was.
They use the word apartheid to compare the two situations. Let's let Mike get in on what he thinks there might – we could possibly – not we, but anybody – could make things better over there.
Well, as John was speaking, and he was speaking well, I began thinking about other states that are theocratic in nature in the Middle East. And I'm wondering whether there's something in the water or what it is about that area that has people moving toward being in some way either Sunni-based, Shia-based, Jewish-based. As a nation, because I think it's important to think about Israel as not as having been there for a long time, but not really, and arrived as a nation state in the modern world recently, but not being so different in some respects in the way others are doing their nations.
Is it all about survival?
Well, but this peculiar kind of, I mean, I'm thinking about the rest of the world. And yes, there are nations around the world that have a variety. We can look at India, we can look at other places, but the Middle East in particular as kind of the birthplace for a number of religions.
The big three.
Yeah, as your discussion, Paul, began initially, saying, okay, there's something about religiousness for people who live there that infuses their national identity, maybe in a different way than some other places in the world. I just throw that out.
Okay, let's get into a little bit more background here about this Sunni-Shia split. Yeah, that split in 632 could be compared to the Catholic-Protestant split of Christianity in Renaissance Europe. But while the Protestants and Catholics seem to have less bloodshed in their disputes these days, the Sunni-Shiite conflict is as violent as ever. The civil war in Syria has government forces led by Bashar al-Assad, who is a Shiite and supported by Shia Iran, and the Hezbollah, also Shia. The rebel opposition, ISIS, al-Qaeda, Syrian Democratic Forces, are Sunni, along with 75% of the population of Syria that's still hanging around in Syria. That's just Syria. In Yemen, the Hadi government is Sunni, supported by the Sunni foreign governments led by Saudi Arabia. The Houthi rebel forces are primarily Shia and are supported by Shia Iran. Are the American people even aware of this dichotomy, this Sunni-Shia thing?
From my conversations with people, especially once, you know, I came back from visiting and people would – they would group everything from roughly – Pakistan to Morocco as the Middle East, which there are some similarities and there are some things that unite that large swath of land, but there are also all those little divisions,
so
and they get broken down more and more.
Viewed more as just like one kind of monolithic entity as opposed to these two separate things described as Sunni and Shia.
Yes, people would, you know, if you ask them to draw it on a map, and they would probably just put a big circle around half of southern Europe as well and not know a lot of that difference. My biggest thing from the time I spent over there was there are as many variations over there as there is everywhere else.
Neighborhoods.
Yep. Neighborhood to neighborhood. You know, sometimes it's something as small as the color they wear. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's funny when you brought up the Sunni-Shia split. Well, we've also got the Turks. We've got the Kurds. You know, we've got the Yazidis. And they all have their own flavor of everything. And again, it seems to be oversimplified, especially with like the, you know, in a group
but
setting like
those,
this.
But even those itemized that you just pointed out, mm-hmm. they're still like under the main Sunni Shia umbrella.
Yes, they are. Yeah. And then you've got, you know.
So what the question is what about us? What about the Americans? Are we educated enough, sophisticated enough in this topic to even know what's going on?
Well, I mean, I remember, you know, 30 years ago, the Sunni-Shia split was not so politically relevant. I mean, and
so you're saying it's become more relevant in the past?
Yes. I think that what you've seen, you know, since, oh, gosh, well, since the Iranian Revolution, but you know, certainly since the 80s, is that you've seen political actors in the Mideast, regimes in the Middle East, you know, local regimes, local leaders attempting to legitimate their own despotic and authoritarian power over their own people by exacerbating this sort of conflict. So the Saudis, for example, I mean the House of Saud, you know, tries to hold itself out as this sort of defender against what's really Iranian encroachment, but there's Shia encroachment from the Saudi view. Now, when I say the Saudi view, I mean I'm talking about the House of Saud. The thing about Saudi Arabia, and this is important, is that in Saudi Arabia, there's a minority Shia population. And where does that population reside? That population tends to reside up in the north, along the coast, but also inland, right where the biggest oil fields for Saudi Arabia are. If the Shia, who are an oppressed minority in Saudi Arabia, if they were to revolt or engage in any kind of serious, you know, armed uprising, it would put the security of those fields in danger. And so this really has the House of Saud on pins and needles all the time.
Well, the war in Yemen is a clear example of their being on pins and needles.
Yeah, and, you know, why the Saudis, you know, have pushed so hard in Yemen, I don't know. That's been a real head-scratcher for me. To a certain extent, it's a proxy war, obviously, between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Well, the Houthis are Shia. Iran supporting them.
In Iran, and this is another thing, is that you have the Iranians who don't, you know, they don't speak Arabic. You know, they speak Farsi, Indo-European language. But the Iranians do... Really, the Revolutionary Guard of Iran has been very aggressive in reaching out to whomever it can throughout the Middle East. And the entree that they have to these different groups in the Middle East that is the Shia connection.
Correct.
So in Lebanon, they reach out to the Shia in Lebanon.
In Syria.
Who again, were an oppressed minority. They or maybe attempting this in Saudi Arabia. I mean, they certainly would do it if they could. They do it in Yemen with the Houthi. They back the Alawite-based regime in Syria.
Well, in Iraq, it's primarily Shia. They made inroads there as well.
Yes, yes. But then again, you also have these countervailing cleavages where, so for example, when the Iraq War started up, of course, the folks who knew something about Iraq, we basically were under the impression that the big winner of this war is going to be Iran because we will go in, we'll topple Saddam Hussein, we'll get rid of the Sunni dominance of that place.
While they're keeping their powder dry.
And then Iran will be able to move in, especially to the south, because there's a geographic component to this where the Shia Arabs tend to be in the southern part of Iraq, right near Iran. Well, it's interesting what we've seen recently where the Iraqi Shia are now sort of turning against Iran a bit.
Oh, really?
So Bani Sadr, who is the sort of the a very important power broker within Basra in southern Iraq, you know, he's concerned about losing his power and his what autonomy he has to the Iranians.
So he's a little bit worried about the foreign invaders, even if they are the Shia.
Correct. So so all of these things, I mean, and this is why the Mideast is such a mess, and this is why I am of the opinion the U.S. is best to just stay out of the place. It's not that we can't understand it, like, through some sort of lack of information on our part, although that's true. It's just the system is so complex. I'm not sure anyone can really understand it. Even if you do understand it, there don't seem to be any right answers because you have these religious cleavages. You have real national cleavages. There is somewhat of an Iraqi identity. There is certainly an Iranian identity. There is certainly an Egyptian identity.
So there's a national identities as well so you as have these, allegiances to the Shia.
And then you have these tribal identities. And the tribal identities are frequently coupled with an religious identity. So it's really – it's very, very – complicated. And of course, the political actors there are used to this complexity. So they're very used to playing a very much more complex chess game than I think.
They're skilled politicians.
Yes.
We are bridging the gap on KVRF Radio, Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. We're talking about the Middle East with Michael Kaler, John Robertson, and Mike Molesky. So, Mike, it's your turn to tell us about the issue that we were just exhausting.
Well, John and I had a brief interaction prior to the beginning of the panel, and while I believe that the history is both interesting, important to understand, because it leads us to this idea at the present time, it's very complicated, and it is. But really what we're saying, and I think the thrust of your questions earlier, was okay, given that, and if we lay out even more of the complexity, so what do you do? Because at the present time, while we're recording this, there's been an action taken by the President of the United States to sort of go and cut through. The Gordian knot has been cut, so to speak.
Were you speaking specifically of the withdrawal of troops from Syria? Or?
Yes, starting there, and what is apparently a move in Afghanistan as well. Mm-hmm. But the real question in my mind, and I think why people have reacted as they have, is to say, yes, we believe that withdrawal from a very messy situation is appropriate. How you withdraw makes a big difference. And I think that's where the concern is, just by saying, you know, I'm just tired of this. We're gone. Well, okay. That will have its own set of problems that will derive. So I'm more interested in saying, as you asked initially, okay, what actually can be done to move this forward? And also, simultaneously, having the United States perhaps withdraw from the support of the fighting, but in some way still, it's my thought, to remain connected. You don't want to be disconnected from people, so you're not.
I think they like our air power. I think their air power is a resource that they really appreciate. And you were mentioned earlier about the Kurds and the Turks. Was it you that was talking about the Kurds? Yeah. That really is a very significant aspect of Trump's decision to withdraw, because apparently reports are that he had a phone call with Erdogan on Friday. And, you know, one of the things that was discussed was getting the hell out of the way so he can go after those Kurds that he's so angry at.
The Kurd militia, I don't think that anyone is going to have an easy a time as they think they will. They have a lot of national identity. They are very proud of who they are as a people. They consider themselves a nationality, even though they may be stateless on a map.
They were allied with those 2,000 American troops over there from the reports I've heard.
Yes, yes, they were. We have the American government, if you look back for a long time to before the first Gulf War, we have assisted them in what they have wanted to do. We have protected them with the northern no-fly zone. There was a lot of attention paid when Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons on their villages. And a lot of what we have now over there is with or in that vicinity, and it's a huge calming factor, especially with our air power. That is one place that we currently dominate in that region of the world. And if things are not done in a meticulous manner with people who know all those ins and outs, like you said, with all those political leaders who also have all these religious and tribal alliances, all of those people need to be involved. Because if we simply take 2,000 people who are over there doing what they're doing with those direct ties to the people on the ground, and we remove that, could the power vacuum be filled by people on the ground over there from the local nationals? Yes. Will it? Huge question.
Well, the announcement was made with a video production by the president, pointing up at the dead veterans as honoring them with this decision. But what's that going to do to the Kurds?
Well, I guess I'm going to reject the question. And what I mean by that is that, at some point, I don't care, right?
Okay, I'll just be blunt.
I mean, I'll just be blunt. I'm going to be very realistic here and basically say that, the United States has to look after its own interests. And I think one reason why Trump won the election was he was said, and I think this is a message that resonated with a part of the electorate. He basically said, why are we in Afghanistan? Why are we fighting over there? We don't seem to have any prospect of – I mean, what would victory look like? If you want stability in the Middle East, then what you're going to have – it's not something that's going to be able to be brokered merely between political leaders, because there will always be ambitious new leaders who will want to break that system. Whatever status quo you establish – there are so many complexities over there and so many cleavages and so many groups that there will always be ambitious junior political leaders who will gain an advantage by arguing against the status quo and mobilizing against the status quo.
And gathering followers.
Even when that status quo means peace. So in a situation like that, the question the United States, I think, has to ask after 9/11 is, okay, how do we reduce the odds that there will be terrorist strikes against the homeland United States from this area? And if something decreases the odds of those sorts of activities, then it's in the United States' interest to pursue that strategy. If there is a strategy that increases the odds of those sorts of attacks, then I would say that we should avoid those strategies.
Yeah, but those are subjective. What's going to decrease and what's going to – it can be – but divided in ideological lines.
But of course everything's subjective in this sense, and so you have to sort of muddle through and make your best judgments. Mm-hmm. This betrayal of the Kurds, and that at least some of the Kurds, and that's what it is. This is the maybe the fourth time we've betrayed them.
The list is getting longer,
right? I mean, we were backing Kurdish rebels against Saddam Hussein back in the late 70s, running them out of Iran. And then when the Shah fell, we reversed and we were using Kurds against the Iranians. So it's, our relationship with the Kurds has been, very complex, and we have not always been reliable. That said, if you're looking for a friend in the Mideast who's a reliable partner, I don't know. Maybe you should get some kind of pet dog or something, because the alliances there are transitory.
Well, you brought the subject up about this decision to pull out of Syria. What do you think, good or bad?
Oh, I think on the face of it, given that over the past 2 years, there seems to be a reduction in the availability of good advice, meaning people who know the Middle East can speak to the president and be heard. I think that this is an event where you're jumping off the cliff and you're saying, I hope there's water below, and I'm not sure there is. And what it does do is it causes many people, allies, groups, whether it's the Kurds or others, to say, when at least we do this political negotiation and do our thing, we have some assurance of what's going to happen for a little while. But these zigs and zags are coming more often, so we're not sure that we can even have a conversation that will
be remembered.
And I think that's the danger. But let me throw one other thing out at you, because as we were talking, I suddenly realized, I said, okay, we've been talking about political action groups and military action along the way. But I think we're forgetting that the economies of these areas, what's happening there is critical, whether it's oil and the money that flows, because many of the sanctions that have been applied have had real effect in some places. Iran, for example.
They weren't happy with them, that's for sure.
No. And I'm only suggesting that in part there's a reason why we haven't even touched on immigration. The movement of people, people are moving from places where, yes, there's turmoil.
Hopefully but also we're going to get to that a little bit later.
Later, there's economic difficulties, whether it's Greece or wherever. And those things are at play as well. When you're trying to stir up a group of people or have people support you, it's useful if they are in trouble and you can say, I have a way out.
I think something we need to look at is that we're talking about the amount of knowledge and people that know these things. You know, I'm just one man's view, but I'm not sure if anybody knows the militaristic goings on over in the Middle East better than Secretary Mattis. And with him choosing to take his knowledge elsewhere, what's coming up in the next, few months is going to be very concerning with some of these, some of the forces moving out of the Middle East there, and then without his, his depth of knowledge there, I think that's going to be it's definitely going to be something that we need to look at.
That's something we could comment on a little bit, this Mattis departure. How significant is that?
Extremely.
Yeah, it's, looking at his resignation letter, I mean, it's interesting what he said there, where he said that, I'm paraphrasing him, but he said, Mr. President, I believe that the United States needs to be a trustworthy ally and also we have to act in the world through alliances and with allies and in concert with them. And those are relationships we need to build and maintain. And you clearly need a defense secretary who goes with your views, which are not my views. So I think that tells us a fair bit about Donald Mattis's views of Donald Trump and
or their relationship anyway.
About their relationship and Trump's views on foreign policy, and how the loss of Mattis there is kind of a loss of ballast on a ship that's rather top heavy. But I want to go back to something that Mike brought up, and I will say this: the prospect of immigration from refugees fleeing a Mideast even in more turmoil than it currently is, in going to Europe and thus destabilizing Europe, which we've seen.
Big part of this story.
Which then affects the United States. So, before I was like, we need to be primarily focused on terrorism. And if something is not intersecting with terrorist attacks against the United States, maybe we really shouldn't worry about it. In fact, maybe a lot of our activities, give more encouragement to terrorism. But the thing about immigration to Europe, that is also destabilizing. And that is perhaps something that we do need to be concerned about in the United States. And I don't mean, controlled immigration. I'm talking about literally if you end up in a situation where you literally have millions of people fleeing for their lives, and rationally and rightfully and properly so,
as they seek
to protect their families and their children. Nevertheless, it has this destabilizing effect on Europe. And like it or not, in terms of the international world order, we are tied to Western Europe.
We are tied to Western Europe. We are tied to everyone now economically, with as far as the world commerce goes, global supply chains. But with this immigration coming, I think that something we need to think about is how do we – pick my words very carefully – stop these people from coming over without us using force. They need to have a place where they feel safe, where they feel that they will be as safe where they are in their, their current land or any other land they choose, as they would be here. Because that's why people want to come here or to other places, Western Europe and Australia, places in the Pacific. They think there's going to be a better economic chance for them. Their family is going to be safer. How do we assist these people to where we don't have this one this huge block of people in what we currently call the United States, and that's where everybody in the entire world lives because that's where they all want to feel safe. Well, how do we make that and get that elsewhere, get everybody feeling safe and make everywhere economically viable so that they don't feel like they need to come here?
I don't think it's an impossibility, but the rules that are currently in place are not conducive for it working. The America absorbed a tremendous number of immigrants between, I say, 1850 and 1930, and they still kept coming. And it really hasn't hurt us as much, but it still has to be managed in a way that and I blame Congress on not setting together the framework where it can be managed, because it's really not manageable now. But I want to get into another topic, which refugees in Europe from the Middle East is a huge problem, but I want to talk about the our military excursions into the region, the ones that we can cite publicly, their record of history. And I want to start off with the 1983 peacekeeping mission in Lebanon. And that ended when two trucks hit the barracks in Beirut, killing 307 people, including 241 Marines. We all remember that one. Reagan pulled the Marines out immediately, but within 2 days he launched the U.S. invasion of Grenada. So everybody remembers that? That was pretty scary times. Second, we had Desert Storm. That was 6 weeks of air assault, 100 hours of ground operations. George H.W. Bush was the commander-in-chief at that time. General Schwarzkopf allowed Saddam to keep his attack helicopters, which he used to decimate the Shia uprising in Basra, killing tens of thousands of people after H.W. said, go ahead and take your country back. And then the third one was the invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11, which that occurred 2 years later, 2003. And then we had the the Iraq War was 2.5 years after Afghanistan. But we had news today about that particular theater. That's 17 years old. And there's some concern about whether it's worked or not. As part of the Arab Spring, NATO air forces, primarily American fighter bombers, helped depose Gaddafi in Libya. That was another involvement of American military power. Next was the fight against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And now we have the Saudi-led war in Yemen, which is taking a lot of American logistical support. We've been refueling their jet fighters. The question is, I went through a long narrative there, are there any lessons to be learned from U.S. military involvement in these Middle East nations? Can we draw any conclusions, if you list them all like I just did, about those particular wars, or is everything going to be different anyway?
A place can only be peaceful if the people who live there are fully dedicated to achieving it.
Whoa, okay. I believe that's true. Absolutely believe that's true. How does U.S. involvement relate to the statement that you just made? Military involvement.
Because if we as the United States send our military over there, we can do a certain number of things and we can stop any immediate threat in the entire world or any immediate threat that the world has ever known. The problem is if we go in there and we remove one person or a capability, all those can be rebuilt, and any person who chooses to rebuild them will. So American military power, with as good as it is and as precise as it can be, is not perfect, and it is never going to be the end-all, be-all. The use of military force is only an extension of diplomatic action. It's the last extension, and
so
the less we can use it, the better.
So what I'm hearing you say is a local political will.
Yes.
The requirement,
yes,
to make it work. What do you think about this?
Well, I think Mike raises a very excellent point here. When you look at especially some of the countries, and I'm here thinking primarily of Iraq, but the same thing is true for Afghanistan as well. Any of what we would call the nations there that are still largely organized along tribal lines it's very fertile ground for insurgencies against occupying military forces from outside. And the reason why is this, is that if I'm an Iraqi and someone comes and kills one of my cousins, say my cousin is, he's some kind of extremist. And so he goes and he fights the Americans and he's killed. Maybe I did not share my cousin's views at all. Maybe I even like the Americans. But guess what? Once my cousin is killed, I am obligated to balance this, and I am actually morally obligated to kill someone from anyone from the tribe who has killed a member of my tribe. This is the way that, justice over there, traditional justice over there works. You lose one of your group to the other group, and then you balance this out by killing one of them. Now, they have ways of dealing with this. Money can be paid. This is why, you'll see in the news, Americans, they'll conduct an airstrike, and we will kill some, there'll be some, collateral damage. We'll kill some people we didn't really intend to kill, and then their families come, and we pay them money, and then that's good. Like, okay, there's
a settlement.
There's a settlement. It's called a blood price. And you pay the blood price. And depending on who you kill and what kind of person they are, the price is higher or lower.
So has there been a lot of American blood prices paid by American
military?
Well,
in Afghanistan we do it. In Afghanistan we've been paying them. Now, okay. Did we do this in Iraq? I don't know. I'd have to go back and rethink. But I know that in the run-up to the second Iraq war, W's war, a lot of us were like, we're going to go in there, and for every, it's like Mike said, every time you kill one of them, you have now made 10 enemies. Okay, and they are obligated, regardless of what their feelings were prior, right? Plus, you do have somewhat of a national sentiment in some of these places where, the Americans are still the foreigner, right? I mean, what would we do in our country if foreigners came here and attacked us and even if they were going to be a peaceful occupying force, what would we do? Well, we would fight them, of course. And that's what these people do. They're in their homes, and foreigners come with weapons.
We're bridging the gap here with Michael Kaler, John Robertson, Mike Bielewski. We're talking about the Middle East. Go ahead, Mike. I interrupted you.
Well, I'll take a slightly different tack. I remember as the war began in Afghanistan and Iraq, after a few years, there were a number of books that came out. I read them, a number of them. They were written by military people, generals, who were involved in the process, had been sitting in the decision-making places where it was decided to go in to do this or that. And I think it's safe to say I took away a sense that there was this political decision made. It was made with precedent, others, to do this. But the actual planning of both the military activity beyond the immediate part of that, or for more importantly, what would happen should you win this or that, was sorely missing And they kept saying over and over again, we just shook our heads. Because you asked the question, why are we doing this? Why are we being sent? We're committing a large quantity of people and resources and doing that. It could be justified in a kind of a political sense, but the rest of it was missing. And I think that's an important point. I'll draw your attention to one other book. It's entitled First In, written by a guy by the name of Gary Schroen. He was about to retire from the Central Intelligence Agency. And he got a call, and he said, because of his experience in that area, would he be willing to go and see what was happening? This was right after 9/11, before Afghanistan became a place with many military people. So he said, okay. So he got his stuff together, and he went. But if you read
he went to Afghanistan?
Yeah.
You say he went to Afghanistan. Okay.
So he goes there, and, I mean, you have to understand that the agency is a pretty sophisticated group. Military is as well. But this was starting with very little in place. I mean, he was knowledgeable because he had language, he'd been there, et cetera. But we had very few people who could do that. And then expanded a bit as you have people with experience. But you're making a decision about going into a place where you have the history of the Soviets who went in and were really hurt badly by that. And there we were going back and saying, well, we didn't learn. We'll do it differently. Well, maybe. So I'm thinking that the decisions to do these things for all the wars that you listed were made with what seemed in the quiet of a conference room to be, yeah, that's a good decision. We have the capability. We can do it. And so you went and did it. And then you said, oh, but now what?
So it was a lack of thinking about the political and cultural aspects that got you to now what?
There are some other interesting things that we, in our interconnected world, that we don't think about. So we were on the Jalalabad to Kabul road in 2005-06 timeframe. And we were stopped beside the road and we were doing some things and
This is Iraq.
No, this is in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, in vicinity of the Nangarhar province between Jalalabad and Kabul. And we seen a gentleman and what looked like his son and their donkey coming down the hillside. And they come down and they get to us. And a couple members of my unit were of extremely dark complected, and he kept staring at them. And at first, it wasn't any big deal. And then it started to worry people. And then one of the dark-complected people looks at our interpreter and says, why does he keep staring at me? Like, he's starting to make me nervous. Why does he keep staring at me? And then our interpreter, understanding the complexity of what was going on here, looks at him and he goes, he talks with the gentleman for a bit. And then he goes, he did not know that there were black people in Russia. And all of us went, we kind of looked around at each other for a minute. And then we realized that this individual, local national, Afghan, did not know that we were not Russians. And this is in 2005. He thought that the Russians were still there. He lived so far back in the mountains and his village had not been contacted yet.
Sounds like somebody up in Trapper Creek.
Yeah,
that.
excellent story.
That's me in Trapper Creek.
And so, for us down here, we're like, you brought up, oh, this happened. We're all getting on our smartphones and researching what's going on today within hours or minutes in, someplace halfway across the world. And this guy, it had been 15 years, and he didn't know that we weren't them. And
well, he got out of Dodge, and he kept his head low and didn't hear anything and was just fine with that.
Yes, he was.
We saw the black people in the Russian army.
Yeah, and we were, good afternoon. We're the U.S. Marines. And he's like,
I want to talk a little bit about another dynamic here. That
great point.
The phrase, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, leads me to question regarding enemies of Iran. Are Israel and Saudi Arabia allies because of their distinct hatred for Iran? How about Egypt?
Well, that's a great question. You know, that's a great question. And I guess I would say this, you know, well, I think we can look at enemies or friends in two different ways. And what I would mean by that is, if you mean the, say, the military aspect of this, then certainly Saudi Arabia and Israel are certainly military allies of us against Iran. And Iran is certainly, there are certain very important elements within the Iranian regime that are revolutionary, and they want to export that revolution. I mean, they're basically Trotskyites. Just imagine, you know, they're like Trotskyites with a revolutionary Islamic ideology, where they want to spread, spread sort of theocratic-based states, dominance, you know, in different parts in the Middle East.
But Iran and Saudi are very theocratic.
Saudis, the Saudi Arabia is literally the Arabia of the Saud family. I mean, it's as if Mike took over a large part of Alaska, and we just called it Mike's Alaska, and he owned it, and his family owned it. That's what Saudi Arabia is. It is a true monarchy. It's true they have a constitution, but it's not a constitutional monarchy in any sense of the like we would ever really use the term normally.
God can't be denied. The Saudi the royal family's connection with the religion.
The Saudis royal family
is big.
Yeah, the Saudis royal family certainly legitimates their rule because they are keepers of the two holy cities of mm-hmm. Mecca and Medina, mm-hmm. They've made a devil's bargain with the most fundamentalist elements of their own society to legitimate their rule. But the House of Saud itself, I don't know. I've seen some Saudi princes in Cairo. They didn't seem so. Religious to me.
They behaved less religious.
And they're notorious. And they're notorious for this.
In the clubs and that. Go ahead, Mike.
You see a very similar thing when you go over to some place like the United Arab Emirates, where, you know, you have, you know, the Sheikh Zayed Mosque, and it's, you know, the minarets are literally coated in gold. And then you see some of the things going on over there, and you see people in, you know, in their tribal or nationalistic regalia, and you're like, oh, that's Maker's Mark. And you're like, oh, that's interesting. You know, and these people who using a religious belief system to shore up a political belief, which, you know, is not a lot different than other places you go where you find something that you can grab a hold to and get a lot of people on your side.
To belong to something that you may be able to control.
But, you know, I want to – because you also asked about Israel. And I think that's something that's unappreciated by a lot of Americans, although it's a matter of great debate within the American Jewish community, is the extent to which Israel is undergoing a cultural shift. So, you know, Israel used to be Israeli Jews were sort of divided. You had very liberal Jews over there. You know, there was a strong socialist element actually within the Zionist tradition. I mean, the Zionists, many of them were initially socialists.
Well, the kibbutz is a socialist organization.
You know, the kibbutzim, you know. And then, you know, on the other hand, though, you do have, you know, very conservative Judaism as well. And what's happening in Israel, you know, really since the Second Intifada, which was in the early mid-90s. And that was the intifada, not of the teenagers throwing stones, which was the first intifada, which people may remember, but it was an intifada of suicide bombers and follow-on bombers, where they would detonate one bomb and then people would go to help and then they would have send in a second bomber. They were putting bombs on buses, they being the Palestinians, mm-hmm. right? Okay. And it was out of that, you know, there were some first serious overtures made between the Israelis and the Palestinians to come up with a peace settlement. But now all that's kind of gone by the wayside because there was so much anger, and legitimate anger, in the Israeli population for that Second Intifada, where on that basis you've now had Likud, political party, be able to become really the dominant party in that country. And working with a coalition with parties that are even more to the right, where basically they're going to go for a ethno-national state, not a two-state solution, and not even have this idea that Arabs can be full and complete citizens of the state of Israel, but it is going to be a Jewish state, period. Mm-hmm. And what this means is that that is not a liberal democracy, because in the long run, the Arabs have a higher birth rate. So what's going to happen in the long run in Israel is that you're going to have a Jewish minority attempting to rule over an Arab majority. And that is a model of government that is basically not along the lines of what the United States model is. And this is known. And this is obvious.
But we're headed there.
But here's the thing. What this means, though, is that at least within the American Jewish community, American Jews are having to make a decision. Look, do we continue to support this ethno-national state, or do we believe that the great hope to maintain Jewish safety in Jewish security is not a state like that, but in fact a liberal democracy like the United States, where religious diversity
where we can be
is
both,
accepted.
Both free and safe. Mike, you got the last word here. We're running out of time.
I'm satisfied with where we've gone. We have covered the ground. We've laid it out very nicely by starting with the beginnings of the religious splits. And I think John has very nicely here pointed to the future and the self-defeating, really, direction.
Doesn't look bright.
Does not look bright. Right. Yeah. So
what about this Israel and Saudi allies? Could you give a little comment on that before we go?
I immediately you asked the question, I'm thinking levels. There's a cooperation here, but that doesn't mean you don't be opposed there. It's not just one level.
Keep your, you talk about the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, I'm going to keep my friends close, but my enemy's closer. So really it's you can never completely trust anyone in an aspect where alliances are as fleeting as they are when you have that many inputs into someone's allegiances.
So much self-interest. I want to thank you guys for coming by. A great discussion. Mike, John, Mike, appreciate it. All you out there in Radio Land, thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.